This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Join our conversation about the week's news on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook Live today. It's very exciting. We're happy to be on Facebook Live. You can call us at 860-275-7266 if you want to join the conversation. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Toilets. I just thought I wanted to be the first person to say toilet.
We may be talking about toilets later on in the program. Thank you for joining us. Max Reese is here. He's a political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Hello there, Max.
Hey, good morning, John.
And Suzanne Bates, policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Hello there once again, Suzanne.
Good morning.
So we're going to start on the governor's race, and we're going to go on the Republican side. Maybe in a little bit we're going to talk about some of the actual plans that the candidates are putting forward. Not a whole lot of actual plans so far. And we'll probably be talking about some of the other less savory things they are talking about, like how many toilets each of them have. But we have been trying to keep track, Colin, of who's exactly going to get on the ballot and who isn't. Republican Bob Stefanowski is seeking to become the first petitioning candidate in either party to qualify for a primary for governor. It looks as though he's doing pretty well. In terms of getting on the ballot, Colin, what are you seeing right now as these people race to get qualified for the August 14th primary?
Well, the truth is nobody knows anything. I mean, the deadline's, I believe, next Tuesday. At that point, Secretary of State's office is going to, I assume, go into overdrive certifying all this stuff. I don't think they've ever had quite the load of signatures that require certifying in any – I mean, first of all, petitioning onto the primary ballot, I think, is no older than 2004. And so obviously you have just a preponderance of candidates doing it this time. I don't know. I don't believe anybody until the signatures are certified. I mean, all the candidates have great stories to tell about how many signatures they've got, but they do have to be certified. There are people who sign petitions thinking they are registered Republicans or registered Democrats, and it turns out they're not. They're, you know, paperwork problems. It's all going to be each sheet. Each person has to sign a sheet that is dedicated to that person's town. So we'll see. I would assume that the people like Stefanowski and Stubberman who are hiring professional firms that charge you a lot of money to get these signatures are going to get their signatures.
And what are you hearing from candidates, Max?
Well, it's funny watching the process in person. Joe Ganim invited reporters kind of go along with him in different neighborhoods around the state. And when I went with him it was in the Blue Hills neighborhood here in Hartford, and he's going up to people. His charisma is kind of remarkable, even on the street. And he goes up to these people, and he goes, "Oh, where are you registered to vote?" And they won't really hear that question, and then they'll say, "Oh, I will totally write down for your petition. Oh, what's your address?" And they start writing it, and it's on a Hartford sheet of paper because it has to be for the city or the town that they're registered in. And then they'll say, "Oh, but I actually live in Newington. Is that okay?" And Joe Ganim scratches off the name Hartford at the top and changes it to Newington. You can do that because mm-hmm. it was the first name on the sheet. But that's how this process is. It's arcane. And I agree with Colin. We're really not going to know until we know who's done this.
And Suzanne, we had a little debate last week on the program about whether or not this is the right way to do it, whether or not the bar for entry is too high or too low. As we've been saying, Democrats, because there's more Democrats in the state, need to reach a higher threshold to get these petitions in. Republicans, the threshold is somewhat lower because there's fewer Republicans in the state. Does this seem about right to you in terms of the way people petition onto the ballot?
I think it should be easier to get onto the ballot. It's also harder to find Republicans, right? I mean, it's a little easier to find Democrats.
If you're a Republican, you're basically on the ballot, right?
Right. So I think that, you know, it's too hard. It's too hard to get on the ballot. It's interesting, though, when you think about the process, it gives these candidates who are petitioning a chance to touch a lot of voters, you know, and to have their name get out there to a lot of voters. So there is that benefit to Joe Ganim and to Stefanowski and Stemmerman. So
yesterday, I think it was on David Stemmerman's Twitter page. He was in Reading or it was on Tuesday. There must have been some kind of a referendum or a budget election down in Reading. It was Election Day. There he was super early in the morning and then later in the evening in front of a polling place. You're not seeing Tim Herbst and Mark Boughton doing that. It's kind of, you know, and that's not meant as a dig. It's just meant that's what David Stemmerman has to be doing. But he's able to introduce himself in ways and people say, "Oh, did you meet maybe that guy at the polling place?" It's something that you don't necessarily see all the time.
Right. So, I mean, another thing that it could conceivably do is acquaint people with the fact that there actually is a primary in August, which they may not have otherwise known. Now, whether they'll remember it for 24 hours is another question. I do think for the Republican side, the math of this is interesting, and I do feel as though it can disadvantage them. I mean, they now have a situation where they will probably have either five or six gubernatorial candidates. I think Loretti is probably the big question mark at this point. Five or six gubernatorial candidates going into August 14th. 4 years ago, fewer than 80,000 Republicans voted in the primary, which was McKinney versus Foley and three people running for lieutenant governor. So let's just say that because these people have some fan bases and they've been kind of out there talking to people and getting signatures, and maybe it goes up to 100,000. Still, you've got five or six candidates fighting over 100,000 votes. You could win pretty easily with, say, 25, 26,000 votes. Or maybe 30,000 votes, and then head into a general election where a million votes are cast. So for the Republicans, it could be a somewhat perilous thing. You're not really testing the waters of popularity very effectively.
Mm. Well, except then that's maybe where why it's so hard to get on the ballot is maybe a good thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because then you've sort of tested people at some level. They've either had to, you know, create some kind of organization to get on the ballot petition or, you know, impress enough people at the convention. So, well, I still think it's better not to make it easier. You know, I do think that there has been some vetting that's been going on.
One thing I think that Connecticut could inherit from other states would be a runoff provision of some kind. I mean, that would be, you know, for those who aren't familiar.
Not a jungle vote like yesterday.
Yeah, right. You know, for those who aren't familiar, the way it works in many other states, it's not even like a southern or midwestern thing. It's just kind of all over the country. There's first the primary and then the top two move on in a runoff. As long as they meet a certain percentage threshold. If there was ever a year that Connecticut needed something like that, this is the year where voters would maybe, you know, look, and then it starts back to the problem, right? Are these really the candidates you wanted? Is this really a choice or was it the establishment parties? But at least at the end of the day, the person who gets the nomination doesn't have 20%. They have 50%, which is a different kind of.
And as Colin's saying, very different than what we've been hearing about in California yesterday, in which is basically everyone's thrown onto this primary ballot and then the top two come out of it. If the top two are Democrats, great. If the top two are Republicans, great. And Democrats, of course, had so many people running in some of these races, they were worried they weren't actually going to get a Democrat on the ballot.
Right. So in California, the Democratic equivalent of what the Republicans are looking at here in Connecticut could be disastrous because you've got five or six candidates splitting up the vote into tiny little fragments. It's not a problem. That's not a problem for the Republicans this time around, except insofar as I think the other thing it does is open up the race more to game theory than anything else. So, I mean, I think Tim Herbst has identified the idea that if you have nobody to the right of you, you conceivably you can pile up a bunch of votes that you don't have to fight for on either side of the ideological spectrum. I mean, I think increasingly the candidates are looking at this and thinking, how do I come out of this with, you know, what do I need? How do I get those votes? And it may have less to do with your ideas and more to do with how you position yourself.
Well, let's turn to Tim Herbst. I mean, he is staking out this position to the right of the rest of the field. He's taking on his top challenger for the job. Mark Boughton, I don't know, Colin, is this going to resonate with Connecticut voters, this kind of a wild-eyed guy who seems to be insulting his competitors at every turn?
I don't know. I mean, prior to 2016, I mean, I think Tim Herbst is like Joffrey Baratheon, you know? I don't think, I personally would be very uncomfortable with a Herbst regime, but I don't vote in the Republican primaries, and clearly there's a whole wave of voting that's going on right now that doesn't necessarily conform to our previous expectations. If I'm Ned Lamont, and what a thought that is, but if I'm Ned Lamont, I don't want to run against Tim Herbst. Maybe of the whole five or six of them, I don't want to run. I don't want to run against a guy who will essentially say anything or do anything to take me out. I think Herbst has a lot of problems. I mean, his biggest problem is Trumbull. The people at Trumbull can't wait to tell you stories of stuff that Tim Herbst did in Trumbull that doesn't conform at all to anybody's idea of good governance.
But also, it's so much of what Tim Herbst is doing is a product of this convention system that we've talked about on both sides, where if you're a Democrat, you have to placate to a liberal or progressive base to get to do well at the convention. If you're a Republican, it's similar, a more conservative base. You got to do it twice. You got to do it in the convention, then you got to do it for heading into a primary because of registered Republican voters. Tim Herbst is trying to make the stake as the true conservative, but also the tough guy in the race. And as we spoke about earlier, if there's going to be six people running and he ends up with between 20 and 30% of the vote because those people who he's placating to are going to like that a lot, then he's your GOP nominee for governor. So I'm not sure it's actually a bad tactic at all.
Okay. What do you think about this, Suzanne? You're our conservative and a nice conservative who doesn't insult anyone.
Token.
I mean, when you said token conservative, I resent that.
I'm kidding.
But what do you think about Tim Herbst and taking this path? Because this, unlike some of what Max just said, this doesn't seem like someone who's staking out a position as a true conservative in order to differentiate himself. It sort of seems like this is a little bit who Tim Herbst is. He's a little bit in the mold of a lot of modern Republicans who are running at the national level.
So I think that, you know, what we're really trying to figure out is what does the electorate want, right? What do the Republican primary voters want? And I think they want someone who can beat the Democrat. So if they think Tim Herbst can beat the Democrat, I mean, there is some parallel to what happened at the national level in the next election, last election, only because Republican voters in 2016 were angry. And I think that that's probably true here as well. You know, I mean, after 8 years of Daniel Malloy and how bad things have gotten in Connecticut, there is a lot of frustration. But I don't think I really think that at the end of the day, what they really want is someone who can beat the Democrat. So I think that's the message that's going to resonate with most Republican primary voters.
And I think that's also why Mark Boughton's responses have been kind of this, okay, Tim, everything's going to be all right. Just bring it down a notch. Because Mark Boughton is going at this in a completely different way, saying, look, you guys want to win. Let me be the guy who's there because I can actually win.
Mm. I think also, I think one thing that maybe we in the press need to sort of look at and stress is a concern that I would have about Tim Herbst is a repeat kind of the Malloy phenomenon, where Malloy had a lot of trouble getting along with anybody, people in his own party, people in the other party, and that contributed. If you think that state government has been stalemated and ineffectual for 8 years, which a lot of people think, that's part of it. And it is possible that it might make more sense to have somebody up there with a slightly more conciliatory personality. Now, that's like everybody else. You know, probably everybody else in Connecticut. So then from there, you start parsing it a little bit more. You know, are you looking for a Stemmerman kind of policy wonk guy? Are you looking for Boughton, who kind of knows a little bit more how to play things down the middle? And I don't know how primary voters are going to respond.
I just have to ask about this because we want to go into some of the details of the Stemmerman plan, which we've seen, Suzanne, and you know, I don't know that any other candidates have a plan as extensive as this, so we want to get into the details. But just to this point of when personality actually rolls over into politics, Colin makes a great point that an awful lot of what has befallen Daniel Malloy at the Capitol has to do with his ability, I believe, to get along with people in his own party and in the other parties. And that's where the personality piece of it actually matters in the public policy piece of it. I wonder if Republicans really are, you know, trying to get someone who will win, but then won't be able to, as Dan Malloy hasn't been able to, rally people around him. I mean, that could be a big problem, too.
Sure. I think we have to remember, too, look, I mean, Tom Foley, right, that I think the thing that Stemmerman and Stefanowski are going to have to prove is that they're not Tom Foley, right? And that, so, I mean, Herbst and Boughton kind of are a good counterweight to that, right? And Sitnik sort of falls somewhere in the middle. But there's a lot of baggage for any of these Republican candidates that they're going to have to overcome in terms of what's happened the last few years. And then, I mean, so it was interesting, you know, Tim Herbst kind of compared himself to Dan Malloy in a recent interview. And I wonder how well that will play, you know. It's going to be interesting.
Did he say, I'm a porcupine?
I mean, he said that he's tenacious.
He's a Wolverine, actually.
He's tenacious like Dan Malloy.
I'm a Gila monster. Yeah.
I think there's no question that part of the reason that Dan Malloy is so disliked in so many circles, even his own party, is that he just doesn't get along with a lot of people. And I definitely think that is something that you could certainly see coming hundreds of miles away with Tim Herbst. He doesn't have, Yes, he of course ran the town of Trumbull, but you know, he he has a lot of enemies in Trumbull, even some people of his own party. But I also think, though, if you're a Republican, what's been clear, the messaging has been, is we need to get rid of the Democrats. You need to vote for a Republican. And I feel like if you're a Republican, you're going to work with whoever that person is in the office. And I think you're going to try to make it work as best as possible. That's what I think it looks like, which is why you haven't heard a ton of endorsements coming from a lot of the leadership and things like that.
I want to move on to something our friend Bill Curry would say everyone cares about more than anything else. What do these candidates really want to do? What's their plan? How do they stand on the issues? And David Stemmerman, who is, again, petitioning potentially onto the ballot, he's another one of these Greenwich millionaires. But he seems to have put forward a plan. Here he is with Dennis House on WFSB's Face the State.
We laid out a plan just a few weeks ago specifically on tax cuts. So we're going to take our tax code from 7 taxes and we're going to simplify it to only 3. The lowest tax bracket is going to be 0 for the first 10,000. If you're a middle income person in the 5 to 5.5%, we're going to cut it to 4. And at the top end, it's only going to be 5%.
Okay, so simplified tax cuts, a simplified tax system, Colin. That seemed to work at the federal level. Everyone loves these Trump tax cuts. You just make it simpler, right? I guess the question is, how do you replace all the money that's not going to be collected?
Right. Well, first of all, let's give Stemmerman some credit for having actually a really, really detailed plan and a plan that's not full of weasel words. Suzanne's over there. I mean, really, you know, Suzanne's Justin Bieber is basically a candidate like this, who actually spells out all of his fiscal policies, and they're pretty conservative and stuff like that. As you look at this plan, which, I mean, its strength is in its details and its forthrightness. That may also be in its weakness. Detailed plans are easier to pick apart. That's why people don't do them that much. Talking to Stemmerman, he's clearly a very smart guy. He's a guy who's done his homework. That would be I think he's nothing like Tom Foley. I think he's about as little like Tom Foley as a Republican candidate I've ever met. He's all about the details. Now, you know, Mike Tyson famously said everybody has a plan until they get hit. So looking at this plan, I'll just pick out one thing. He's kind of reliant on some of the work, or at least he's echoing a lot of the work of the Fiscal Stability Commission or the Doomsday Commission or whatever they're called, the Patricelli Smith group. So one of the things that they said was that there are $1 billion in efficiencies that could be just sort of pulled out of the state budget. You asked them, well, who told you that? Well, we asked some of the kinds of consultants that you hire to find those efficiencies. So, you know, if you talk to a plumber, he's probably going to tell you need new plumbing and that he can do it. That's basically how they arrived at that number, was asking the kind of people who they'd wind up hiring to get to that. So, that's a nice thing to say, and I'm not saying it's wrong either, but I mean it's a thing you're saying at the moment, and a lot of things of the plan are things that you're saying. On the other hand, I don't know. I liked talking to Stemmerman because he has a brain and he has ideas and he's not a weasel. People that the press like tend to do very poorly.
Go ahead, Suzanne. What do you think of this plan?
I think it's a great plan. I do think, Stefanowski's put out a plan on income tax. I mean, there are other plans. Boughton has put out plans, and there are other plans that are out there as well. And I think that there are good ideas floating around. I would love to believe that primary voters vote on policy. That has not usually been the case. And it's interesting watching the media kind of push all of these candidates. Oh, we want your details. We want your detailed plans. And then, you know, is that really what the primary voters care about? But I think, you know, to backtrack a little, the thing that all of these candidates are going to face after this election is a monstrous 2019 budget session.
Right.
You know, you're talking about $2 billion deficits for each of the years, a no layoff pledge, which makes it very difficult to find some of these inefficiencies, a CBAC deal or a deal for the state employees that's locked up. I mean, the 2019 budget session is going to be monstrous. And I think Stemmerman has put out a plan that deals with some of those issues and kind of addresses them in a way that is a lot more detailed than some of the others. And I think he has some great ideas.
Just to get back to my original question, where exactly, I mean, we find a certain amount of efficiencies in government. Every candidate, both Democrats and Republicans, honestly, always say, we're going to find some efficiencies, and we never actually find those efficiencies. Where does the money come from to make up for the loss of tax revenue if indeed, as this candidate says, he also wants to invest in transportation, upgrade our roads and trains, and do some of the things that everyone else wants to do?
Well, I think some of that's timing, though, too, right? I mean, do you change things? Do you change the tax code first, or do you get at the spending first? And it's hard when you can't run deficits like you can at the federal level. It would be hard to change our tax code this year unless you're going to rebalance it by increasing the sales tax.
He's got a lot of public-private partnerships in there and
stuff
like that.
And eliminating sales tax expenditures and a number of those other
things. Right. I mean, you can do a rebalance where you're coming out revenue neutral and you're still changing the income tax rates, right? Which is what Stemmerman would like to do. And I think that's actually a great idea because our current tax structure is so volatile, it's a great idea to reduce our reliance on the income tax.
Max, when we were down at Foxwoods, I was talking to Stemmerman, and at the end I said, out of curiosity, how many people work for you right now? He said 35. And I thought, I bet none of them are named Sal Luciano.
Oh, gosh. But, you know, when the thing that grinds my gears during all these debates is when somebody says we're going to eliminate the income tax. Okay, you've blown a $9 billion hole in the budget. That's the idea of it sounds great, and I understand the politics of it. But those states that don't have income taxes, they collect those taxes in other ways. It's obviously not the precise same amount. But with Stemmerman, he at least has this phased-in plan with tiers, a new tax system, gets rid of X number of expenditures and different sales tax exemptions. And you can look at it and say, yeah, you can at least there's a lot of this that makes some sense.
But because so much of it hangs on this idea of public-private partnerships, which I have yet to see develop in the way that they might be envisioned. I mean, we're looking at companies wanting to pick up and leave Connecticut, not wanting to get into bed with Connecticut and try to figure out how to pay for this problem.
Some of the things with the public-private partnerships he talks about, one of the things which doesn't quite pass the smell test as far as infrastructure goes. He says we need high-speed rail to get from Hartford or New Haven to New York City in an hour. You can get from New Haven to the Connecticut-New York border very quickly. We own all of our track. Good luck doing that in New York. There are other infrastructure and regulatory issues and federal transit authority issues and things like that. That all sounds great, but then you dig a little bit deeper and you realize that's not necessarily realistic. But look, kudos to David Stemmerman. You know exactly what this guy wants to do on day one, and you can't say that about just about anybody else running for governor.
And I know Bob Stefanowski and Mark Boughton have both said that they would like to get rid of the income tax, but they're not suggesting that you do it day one, right? I think they both have released sort of these phased plans.
Initially, Mark Boughton said, I'm going to just eliminate it. And now Bob Stefanowski says, I think over 8 years.
I think public private partnerships. I mean, I was just in Canada and outside Toronto, they've got a great road that they privatized. I mean, this is working in other places. I think it could work here, but you run into issues with labor in Connecticut that you don't run into in other places. I think it's going to make it difficult to do it right out of the gate.
They also have a different healthcare system up there too. Uh-huh.
And there's good and bad. Happy to talk to you about it.
Not to just geek out totally on the Stemmerman plan, but another thing that he borrows from, which I think is interesting, from the Doomsday Commission is
is that a working title? The
working
Doomsday
title, Commission. Yeah. I think Danny came up with that. So they said that if you look at what I would call corporate welfare, but you can call it something else, tax breaks. I think they said there's $5.4 billion in just sort of exceptions to the tax code that have been gained by various people. Some of them are sales tax, some of them are income tax, corporate tax, whatever. You know, if you're asking where the money is, well, there's a $5.4 billion, but you know, there might be $1 billion just closing off some of that stuff. A lot of it's probably codified. Some of it's probably a matter essentially of contract. But I mean, that's a lot. That's pork. There's a lot of corporate welfare in there that has piled up over the years, both through Malloy and Roland and Rell before. And maybe there's some money there.
We got to take a break. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about what the Democrats are talking about. Maybe not detailed plans like that. Maybe detailed house plans, like how many bathrooms do I have on the first floor and the second floor? How many are going to go to that new addition? We're talking with Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Suzanne Bates, policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Max Rees, political reporter for NBC Connecticut. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation live on Facebook Live today, as well as on the radio, of course. You can also call us at 860-275-7266 if you want to join our conversations about the week's news in politics. We're joined today by Max Rees, who's political reporter for NBC Connecticut, Suzanne Bates, who's policy director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and our own Colin McEnroe. Colin, what's on your show today?
Well, first of all, tonight I'm going to be at the Mark Twain House with Larry Wilmore. We're going to try to turn that into a show ultimately, but in order to give me an opportunity to get ready for that, we're running what I think is probably my favorite show that we've done this year, and it was one that was probably near and dear to your heart. It was a show we did with jazz musicians. It's so hard to get jazz musicians to really explain to you what they're doing. I've been, as you have, in the presence of them for a long time and working with them on stuff. And I finally broke through. We were in front of a live audience. They played wonderful music, and we had the wonderful jazz vocalist, Atla de Champlain, singing. But we would stop in the middle of stuff, and I'd say, okay, what just happened? Tell me, how are you and Matt communicating? That kind of thing. So anyway, we're rerunning that because we love it so much, and then I'll be with Larry tonight.
Excellent. So a lot going on with Colin McEnroe today, and an interesting show coming up this afternoon. So Joe Ganim trying to get onto the ballot. He's out petitioning to try to get signatures. We were talking a little bit on the Republican side, Max, about how we have these well-heeled candidates who might be able to pay people to go out and get these signatures. Joe Ganim, as you said, doing it on his own, not to get into too much detail, but I mean, how do you think he stands by this June 12th deadline?
It looks like he's going to get there. And it, just because he has so many troops, if you will, on the ground, volunteers who just love Joe Ganim. But to a point that you made at the beginning of the show, it's much easier to find Democratic voters in this state in clusters than it is Republicans. And it's a funny line that Joe Ganim says on the trail talking to these people. We got to hit every city and town in the state. We got to get people signed up. Well, you don't really need to if you're searching for Democratic signatures. You can do it in Waterbury and New Haven and Hartford and Bridgeport and Stamford, which is exactly what he's doing. And he, at last check, he was at about 15,000 signatures, or 12,000 or 16,000. And he's going to get to 18 or 20, it looks like. So I'll have some cover there for when signatures get thrown out. There's no reason to think right now that Joe Ganim is not going to have the signatures to be on the August 14th ballot.
So he's been painting this race as one between him, sort of the man of the streets and champion of the inner cities, and Ned Lamont, someone who Ganim insists doesn't know what it's like to struggle financially. Now, here's Ganim during his petition drive remarking a bit about Ned Lamont's wealth.
Anytime you're going against a multimillionaire who lives in a house with 8 bathrooms, you wonder, you know, what that life is like.
Okay, so it turns out that that comment and a few other comments like that is the news of the week on the campaign trail, Colin. I don't know how many pieces have been written about how many bathrooms the various candidates have, but it's become all about bathrooms.
Right. Well, my new favorite political reporter, Caitlin Kresselt, is that how you say it?
Caitlin Kresselt.
Kresselt, yeah. From Hearst, she kind of counted everybody's bathrooms. Stemmerman has more bathrooms than Lamont. I would say the thing about that was it seemed as though the Lamont campaign was a little flat-footed in knowing how to respond to something like that, and that's the kind of thing that they should be ready for. You know, I mean, you know, if you had Roy Occhiogrosso as your campaign manager, then you'd probably say something like, "Well, that's great, Joe. How many bathrooms are there in the Fort Dix Correctional Institute?"
Oh God!
So I wouldn't advocate that. I don't think that's how – I think when they go low, you go high. Michelle Obama's right about that. I would have liked to have seen, you know, Ned Lamont say, so I'm trying to figure out how to get this state out of an incredibly complicated fiscal mess. Joe is counting my toilets right now. But that's good, Joe. You just keep counting toilets and I'll get elected governor.
But also, if you listen to the way Ganim says that line, it's almost like he's kind of testing out which way sounds the best. Like at one point, he definitely said, you know, look, he's someone with 8 bathrooms. That's the way he lives his life. That's his choice. That's the way he lives his life. I'm on the first floor of a 3-family house, you know, trying to say in this nonchalant way while also digging with the dagger. But I think you're right. I think the Lamont campaign almost had no clue how to really respond to an attack on wealth, which is what we're going to be hearing against Ned Lamont for the next 5 months.
Depending on who he runs against. In other words, like you're Ned, you want to run against Stemmerman or Stefanowski or Obsitnik.
Because then it takes that card away. Right. Yeah.
I have only 8 bathrooms, for instance, is the sort of thing that you say. You know, I don't know. This is what we're down to right now. Suzanne, it seems as though on the Republican side, we're starting to figure out a little bit of a debate about how we might run the state. And this is, I think, what we're hearing on the Democratic side right now.
Right. Well, and it's been interesting listening to Ned kind of run to the left, you know, to win the primary voters over. And you wonder how that's going to play in the general after 8 years of Malloy. You know, and the Republicans are going to do their very best to tie Ned Lamont to Malloy. And I mean, it sounds like he does want to continue a lot of the Malloy policies and the way that Malloy has been doing things. So that, you know, I think Ned Lamont has some baggage. And you're right. I mean, he doesn't necessarily know how to respond to that. And Republicans the last few years, they've been putting forward sort of these wealthy candidates from Fairfield County, and it's been problematic for them. But that really issue is off the table for them this year. They can run a rich guy from Fairfield County. And, you know, when the Democrats, if Ganim doesn't win, I mean, that problem's gone for them.
That's the other way to look at it.
Right?
You know, from a certain point of view, you sort of think, oh, well, let's run Herbst Terbouten or somebody like that because they can make the wealth an issue. But, of course, the Republican way of looking at it goes, hey, it's a good year. Well, we can put a millionaire up there. So I just want to say a couple of things. I think that Ned Lamont, and John, you know Ned Lamont better than I think any of us, really. And he's a really nice guy, you mm-hmm. know, and he's sort of the kind of person who's grown up among at a certain level of comfort, and he just really hasn't had to be ugly and unpleasant. And he's always a little surprised when somebody else is ugly or unpleasant or cheats or says something that's distorting. And, you know, this is a long campaign, and he is going to have to develop – either he's going to have to develop this kind of, you know, Don Knotts perplexity, you know, every time somebody is really mean to him, or develop a little bit of a counterpunch. And I don't know which of the two. The one thing I want to say is – and here I feel like I am way out on a limb, but I might be one of the few people who's not really bothered by the candidacy of Joe Ganim. My theory is he did all this bad stuff and he went to prison, and he's in prison for a really long time too, much longer than people typically go to prison for this kind of stuff. And now he's out, and now he wants to run. And I wouldn't vote for him, but you know, I don't know. I think it's interesting having him in there, maybe sharpening Lamont up a little bit, getting Lamont ready for a general election. I don't think he's a particular threat to make it to the top of the ticket. But, you know, so he's out there, and this is America. He wants to run. If he can get the signatures, you know, Godspeed.
I think that I've tried to come up with a generous way of saying this. I don't think it's really settled into so many people a lot of the original details of Joe Ganim's conviction and time in prison. And I remember when I got to Connecticut, and it was a number of years ago now, and then a couple years after, and I kind of knew the Joe Ganim story a little bit moving here. And then when he announced he was going to try to run for Bridgeport mayor, there were so many people in Connecticut politics who said, I cannot believe he's doing this again. Like,
true.
There was this shock of this guy is so terrible. How can he be doing this? But the reaction to him in cities, it is remarkable. People go up to him on the streets and they hug him. And you know what? It's a free country. You want to run, go ahead. But I think a lot of people don't remember all the details that what led to him going to prison. I think there's some short-term memory.
But, you know, for a long time in between prison sentences, everywhere John Rowland would show up, Republicans
sure.
would mob this guy.
Right.
And, I mean, to me, the difference between Ganim and Rowland was Ganim, they had a wire. If they have a wire, they're going to know everything.
Right.
They never had a wire on Rowland. And the other difference, obviously, is that Ganim fought it, and they make
right.
you pay big for that.
And I think we forget sometimes there's populism going on the right, but there's populism going on the left, too. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, I mean, can you discount Joe Ganim and this? He's been out there talking to voters, you know, and I mean, he relates to them
yeah.
in a way that Ned Lamont might not. And I think, you know, that might help him onto a
But Suzanne, also to your point, he's not running away from it. People
right?
ask him all the time, have you learned your lesson? And he looks them in the eye and he says, yes, I have. And that's why I'm running for governor. You know what? Look, it is a powerful thing on the street. And it's funny. He did such a good job of twisting the whole second chance society thing on its head that the governor talked about. And he's saying, look, I'm the second chance candidate. You know, you don't know where he's probably not. It's a very long uphill fight for him to get the nomination. I think we all know that. But he's doing something that it is politically remarkable what's going on.
At the convention, this is the Democratic convention, and I think Max may have been sitting near me at the time, Ghanem gave his own seconding speech, which
yes.
is unusual, but a smart thing to do because he's got to make that case. And he, once again, he brought that up. He brought the fact that, you know, he did the crime and he did the time. Although we all kind of snorted. At one point he said, I've been mayor of Bridgeport for 14 years collectively.
Yes.
And we all looked at all up and down the press room.
Best descriptor ever.
I kept saying, would like non-continuously be a more collectively isn't really the right adverb.
Before we move on, actually, we got a note from our friend and regular listener, Ken Krajewski, who says, how can you talk about Ghanem's signature drive without mentioning the collateral damage of Cynthia Jennings? Did you see this story? In a sharply worded letter, this is Jenna Carlesso in The Current, Hartford City Clerk John Bozzano notified Councilwoman Cynthia Jennings Tuesday she could no longer remain in her position after the clerk's office learned that Jennings had changed her party affiliation from Working Families to Democrat. It seems as though she changed her party affiliation so that she could help gather signatures for gubernatorial hopeful Joe Ghanem. This is, it's so fascinating, but as we talk about this kind of Byzantine system of going and gathering signatures, figuring out what town you actually live or vote in, this is actually a real thing that happened to a real politician in Connecticut, Colin.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Check the fine print before you do something like that. I don't know. I mean, that's Cynthia Jennings' responsibility to understand that. This is a good time to segue into the fact that we had to get Max out of jail today in order to be on the show today.
Well, why not?
Bob Maxon actually put up the money, so we should, you know, give him credit.
Let's actually talk about this. You know, not many people knew that there was a special election Monday in Hartford, but there was, and Max was assigned to cover this. So what happened, Max?
So we ran into all 12 voters who cast ballots.
6% turnout, ladies and gentlemen.
Right. And we went to Bulkley High School, and this happens, I want to make this so clear, every single election day in Hartford. Us with a TV camera and a microphone and an SUV with a giant peacock on it, we show up to a polling place.
And that's Max's personal car.
That's I drive that. I pick up my twins in that. It's great. And we show up and somebody says, no, you can't shoot video. Or they say, no, you can't stand here. Or they say, oh, you have to sign in when you get here. To which I go, no, none of those things. None of what you just said there is either a requirement or a prerequisite or anything for us to be here. And then people get called. They get angry at us. My blood pressure rises because they're basically saying to us, making up rules where the press can and can't be in a polling place. And someone here, I think it was Carlos who helped set up the Facebook Live today, said, but don't we have video every year of presidents and governors voting? And the answer to that is yes, you do have people, a video of these people voting all the time. And in Hartford, without fail, it happens every single election, whether it's a primary or whatever. And so I was released from prison after my rage. Second chance society. Not true. I'm kidding. But no, it all got sorted out. We were allowed to get our video. We were allowed to talk to some voters. I say allowed because that was the kind of dynamic that was going on. And poll workers were allowed to be there. It's a First Amendment right. We're just covering an election. We're not putting a GoPro on someone's hand as they fill out their ballot. We're just covering it and doing our job.
Although that's an interesting idea.
That is interesting.
I think this is something where the Secretary of State really should get involved. I mean, I still feel, and I'm not blaming this all on the Secretary of State, because there's a lot of towns and there's a lot of poll workers and moderators and registrars, and they're all kind of hard to control. But I mean, I wish everybody knew what all the rules are, you know, and it should be pretty easy to get them on a laminated card.
Well, what?
This is what can happen. And not just with the press, but, you know, we have an incredibly complicated photo ID or non-photo yes. ID rule in Connecticut. But and moderator to moderator, they just don't, you know, have common agreement about this.
Somebody quoted to me at the polling place, well, we have a 75-foot rule. And I say, you're absolutely right. There is a 75-foot rule and it has nothing to do with members of the press.
Right.
It has to do with candidates and campaigns. And yeah, if there was a little piece of information provided to every poll moderator and not even every poll worker, but the person running the polling place on the shift that says the media can do this and here's what's required of somebody to vote, everybody wins.
But there's the media, Suzanne. There's what is required to vote. It really seems as though every single election, a special election in the middle of the summertime, they get 6% turnout, of a primary that doesn't have very high turnout, or a presidential election year, we always seem to have some sort of these problems at some polling places around the state that suggest that we don't exactly know what it takes to vote, to cover voting, to be involved in the political process. And I don't understand why it's so hard to fix.
So I guess, you know, we're relying, I mean, we have this very diffuse system, right? And we're relying on a lot of people who are not lawyers, who don't have, you know, I mean, who, yes, we need to train our poll workers better so that they let the media in. The good news is at the end of the day, you did get in, right?
Right.
I mean, we're very reliant on citizen participation in our democracy. I'm a little worried our primary's in August.
Right.
I don't think we're going to get great turnout. I think people in Connecticut are kind of depressed, too. And I think that's going to dampen turnout. I think people need to get involved. We need as much citizen participation in this process as possible. We need to make sure they're well educated. But the more people that get out there and get involved in this process, the better.
Can I just ask, when would we, I agree with you and I've heard this for years, but when should we do the primary? I mean, if we do the primary too early, then we have a very long, very expensive run up to a general election. If we do it any, we can't do it any later than August. It would be almost impossible for a November election. I mean, where do you put the primary?
I think you put it at the beginning of the summer and then let them go to every fair and every, you know, parade and every, you know, I don't have a problem with people campaigning over the summer. I think it actually leads to more retail politicking.
I think that's right. I mean, yesterday was so-called Super Tuesday. It was just 8 states. But by the way, Los Angeles, I think they lost 118,000 registrations or something like that. So it's not just
minor issue.
Not just us having these problems. But yeah, I think Suzanne's right. I think move it up sooner. Let it be the summer. Max will get no vacation whatsoever. I'm okay with that.
Vacation's overrated.
If I can, dump the conventions, have the primary in June, have a runoff in July if it's required, and then boom, done. And then you're done for the rest of the year.
Hey, Max, since you covered it, who won the special election in Hartford?
Mr. Julio Concepcion did. He is going to, he will only cast a ballot if there's a special session and a veto session. And then he's up for election again in November with every other member of the General Assembly.
All right, we're going to... We're going to take a break, and when we come back...
But it was worth every penny. It was 6% of the vote come
6% out. 6% of the vote. We're talking with Max Reese from NBC Connecticut, Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. This is The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show, Suzanne Bates from the Yankee Institute for Public Policy, and Max Reese, the political reporter for NBC Connecticut. Earlier this week, U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson came to Connecticut and did what cabinet members have often done in the past. They met with a group in need of federal aid, and they listened to their plight. He was standing side by side with the Democrats who represent Connecticut in the state's congressional delegation. Let's listen to a little bit of audio courtesy of CTN.
Some of the materials from this quarry have gone out into other parts of the nation. You know, so we need to be looking at a solution that will help all of our citizens who find themselves in this incredibly terrible situation.
And this terrible situation, 34,000 or so homes in eastern Connecticut with foundations that are literally crumbling, at least partly due to the use of a material known as
Pyrotite.
Pyrotite. And Carson went out and did something. Max, I don't know. I was struck by the fact that not necessarily is Ben Carson going to do anything about this, but that I have not seen too many Trump administration officials out on the road standing next to Democrats in Congress, listening at all to people who are in some sort of trouble. It was striking because it seemed a lot like what happened during the Obama administration, the Bush administration, the first Bush administration, the Clinton administration, sort of what we're used to.
If 5 years ago somebody said to you that Ben Carson would make a visit to Connecticut and stand side by side with Richard Blumenthal and Chris Murphy, knowing who Ben Carson was 5 years ago, you would scratch your head and go, what are you talking about? And also, you know, look, to Ben Carson's credit, his predecessor, Julian Castro, never made this visit about this issue here in Connecticut. And it is clear that Murphy and Blumenthal got in his ear about this. And then also Ben Carson made a comment saying, you know, the insurance industry must have had really good lawyers. How have they not dealt with this? That is like he's been talking with Murphy and Blumenthal for months on this. Not that he just learned about the issue, which is striking.
Yeah, and I think that there are, you know, the Trump administration officials are out on the road, but we're in Connecticut. We don't see them a lot here. You know?
Yeah, well, and I think they should probably come to all 50 states, but continue.
Well, sure,
yes.
But yeah. I mean, you know, maybe they're not as welcome here, you know, as they have been in other places. I think, you know, people on the right really do have a soft spot for Ben Carson. I think he's been really ridiculed on the left. And I think yesterday you sort of saw why it is that he still has a lot of fans on the right. He, you know, he's a decent guy, and he came. And this is really, I mean, at the end of the day, it's not about Ben Carson. It's about these families who are dealing with a really terrible problem. And so, I mean, you know, trying to find a way to help is, I think, important.
You know, one of the things that Ronald Reagan said that I always objected to, he said one of the big lies is, I'm here from the federal government and I'm here to help you. And he saw that as an eternal truth, a congenital problem with government, almost a kind of, you know, a genesis kind of problem, a creation myth problem. And it shouldn't be, right? The federal government should come and help you when you've got a problem like this. So this is Ben Carson doing that. And by the way, yeah, I would just chime in and say, I think the appropriate thing to do about this, I mean, it's going to require some federal money for remediation, probably some state money. But I would say putting a little heat on the insurance companies. I mean, the fact that this isn't covered by policies, I mean, I guess I could kind of sort of understand that. But on the other hand, if you're the insurance industry, it doesn't look good when a lot of people have a problem with their houses and their homeowners' policies don't cover it. And it's a good faith thing. They could get together as a consortium and put up a pot of money.
What I think also is that as a feather in the cap for Blumenthal and Murphy, the two of the biggest critics of Trump, I mean, they tweet about him and talk about him all the time, but they're clearly taken seriously on this issue to a certain extent, which once again, even if you'd said this at the beginning of the Trump administration, any member of the cabinet coming to visit Connecticut, I think I agree with Susan. I think they'd get booed out of a gymnasium in a lot of respects in part of the state. But instead here, welcomed with open arms.
Well, and welcomed. And it helps that the Democrats are reaching out, that the Republicans are coming to the state. It actually felt like a nice story to cover. I just want to quickly get to Zeke, who's calling from Simsbury. Hey, Zeke, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Hi. So I'm a frequent listener, and I have to say I love the program, but I was a little bit jaded by the comments about poll workers. I have worked as a poll worker. I'm only 19, so I worked last year, my election cycle in 2016. And these are people who wake up at like 4:30 in the morning, stay until 10 p.m. when all the votes are counted. And I think we have to be very careful about where we place blame. And I think Suzanne brought up a really good point where we want as many people involved and active in our democracy. And let's not say it's the poll worker's fault necessarily. Let's go for the people who are training them, and let's ask the registrar to be better.
But I think that kind of was our point, Zeke. I mean, I don't think anybody was picking on poll workers here, but I mean, I can tell you that I had to try two or three times periodically at the place that I vote. I've had to go back more than once in order to be able to cast my vote. I don't really blame poll workers for it, but I think it's a big, unwieldy system. As I said, 169 towns, twice as many registrars. They often want to be independent, don't want to be managed by the state. But ultimately, some kind of uniformity would really be really good. This isn't us dissing poll workers, but it shouldn't be that difficult. Voting is a right. You shouldn't have to go in there and argue with somebody about whether you're on the rolls or not.
And the one thing I would say, Zeke, is that the people who were working the polls were great professionals. It was the moderator of the polls that was the problem.
Oh, good.
It was the moderator of the polls who came up and said, no, you can't be here. As far as the people tabulating, signing people in, they're all doing an incredible job. This was, in my case, the one person running the polling place at that time who was making life difficult.
Yeah, Suzanne, do you want to say
something? Yeah, well, my 16-year-old son was a poll worker in 2016, and it was a great experience for him. I mean, he really got that up-close look with – I mean, I think he's going to vote now every year, every time there's an election, which I think is a good thing for
people. Maybe he can bring Bob Stefanowski with him. Just kidding.
And I was going to say quickly, Zeke, and thank you very much for your phone call. The other thing is, I mean, Suzanne's 16-year-old son notwithstanding, you're a little bit of a unicorn at most of these polling places, right? And my polling place in Winsted, everyone is 75 to 80 years old. I mean, do you see a lot of other 19-year-olds and people in college who are doing the work you're doing?
So in high school, I was involved in a group that was getting people from our school to help out at the polls. But outside of that, I don't really see a lot of young people. They're helping or they're voting.
But Zeke, good for you, man.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing. They're helping or they're voting. It's sort of like, and thank you again, Zeke, for your phone call. It's sort of like the conversation we were having earlier that if you go out on these petition drives, you talk to people about the fact that there's a primary coming up. You're getting involved in some way in the system. And just the idea that Zeke is interested enough to get involved in the system to work at the polls suggests that there's a little bit of enthusiasm there, Colm, but whether it's 6% turnout in Hartford or what kind of turnout we're going to see coming up in August, I don't know that there's over overall the type of enthusiasm that we need for the system to work properly?
Typically, national elections, presidential elections, produce a bigger kind of turnout. You have a lot of people showing up at primaries who really are eager to vote and turn out to be unaffiliated voters. I don't think that's going to happen. I think Suzanne's right. I think people are a little bit depressed, and there isn't really sort of a marquee candidate or issue kind of driving passions right now.
Anyway, go Zeke. And thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WMPR. Special event with Larry Wilmore tonight. Colin, when is that happening?
I believe it's at 7:30.
7:30. Very cool. And he's got a show about jazz coming up later on today. Max Reese from NBC Connecticut. Good luck getting into the polls, Max.
Oh, thank you, John.
And thanks to Suzanne Bates, Policy Director at the Yankee Institute for Public Policy. Thank you so much, Suzanne.
Thank you for having me.
The executive producer of our program is Katie Schlarsky. She's back. Kion Wolf is the technical producer. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan and Carlos Mejia.